It's time. Time for stimulating talk. Time for thought-provoking conversation. Time for the Lisa Wexler Show on WICC 600. Turn on your brain and get the real scoop on today's topics and events. Here is Lisa Wexler.
And good morning, everybody. Hello, hello. Thank you for waiting. And thank you for listening to our best ofs. I understand they were very popular. And a happy Martin Luther King Day to you. I hope it was a day of remembrance of some of the wisdom of this great man who graced our presence as a leader and a great, great figure in American history and, frankly, in American popular mind. I'm Lisa Wexler, and good morning, 203-333-9422. It happens that on Wednesdays, which today is, we have Wayne Winston on regularly for a feature on race, and we will actually talk about some of the diversity, equity, inclusion initiatives that are going on, Civilian Review Board discussions in New Haven, Westport, and what's happening in Fairfield on the ground. We'll be joined by somebody who is actually a Black Republican from Fairfield, who is very involved with what efforts Fairfield is trying to make itself a more inclusive and welcoming town. 203-333-9422. But I actually want to begin with a story that broke over the weekend that I am sure caught you, it caught you and got you very upset. It's the story of a woman named Melissa Goh, a 24-year-old woman who happened to work for Deloitte Consulting and was living and loving her life in New York City. And she was an Asian American woman, but I don't know that her Asian had any, I don't know that her Asian ethnicity had anything to do with this, although the Asian community is clearly very energized and upset over what happened. And what happened was that she, at 10:30 in the morning on 42nd Street in Times Square subway station, couldn't have been Michelle Goh. Isn't that what I said? Michelle Goh. Melissa, pardon me, Michelle Goh. I meant Michelle. I said Melissa. Michelle Goh. She was standing there with her friends doing what you do on a Sunday, which is to say getting from one place to the next. And she was shoved right onto the path of an oncoming subway train where she was killed. And her family is still in shock. Her friends are still in shock. Everybody who knew her is still in shock. They all talk about her in the present tense because they can't even comprehend that this extraordinary woman is now gone. And the New York Post has been covering this with a tremendous, they've been covering it tremendously, and story upon story, headlines, hundreds gathering yesterday in Times Square for the subway victims' vigil, denouncing anti-Asian attacks. The suspect in the fatal Times Square subway attack to be arraigned in a hospital, a homeless ex-con. That's how the New York Post refers to him. He may be homeless. He may be an ex-con. He's also someone with the diagnosis of schizophrenia for over 20 years. The MTA exploring platform barriers after the Times Square subway shove tragedy. And we have these clips from Eric Adams, the new mayor of New York City. Andrew, let's begin.
Day one, January 1, when I took the train, I saw the homelessness, the yelling, the screaming early in the morning, crimes right outside the platform. We know we have a job to do, and we're going to do both. We're going to drive down crime, and we're going to make sure New Yorkers feel safe in our subway system. And they don't feel that way now. I don't feel that way when I take the train every day or when I'm moving throughout our transportation system.
Now, that admission has been now referred to in headlines as a stunning admission that Mayor Adams admits he doesn't feel safe riding New York City subways either. This coming after his immediate response, which was a little bit, shall we say, less enthusiastic than this one, basically trying to tamp down people's immediate reaction by saying everything was okay or going to be okay. But now he's changed his rhetoric, and he admits fully that the subway system isn't as safe as it needs to be. You know, there are a lot of ways that we can talk about this tragedy that happened to Michelle Goh. And they're all valid and they're all important. But I'm going to tell you what I think is the most valid and the most important. And I want you to imagine, imagine a world in which a person receives a diagnosis of schizophrenia And that diagnosis is treated as a diagnosis of cancer is today. I want you to imagine that world with me for a moment. When you get a diagnosis of cancer today, you are immediately put into a world of a team. And a team sits at a table, and they address your cancer from tremendously different ways of looking at your cancer. They look at your cancer from the physical component of how to treat your cancer and the chances of getting better from your cancer and the prognosis and the various medicines available and the pros and cons of each one of them. And they look at the long-term prognosis of your cancer and the side effects of your cancer treatment. And they look at how long you're going to need to be in the hospital. And they examine your family system and your systems at home. And they hook you up with a visiting nurse system afterwards for your cancer treatment. And they look at your statistical situation of your cancer in terms of deciding how what stage is your cancer in. Is your cancer staged as a 1, 2, 3, or 4? Has your cancer metastasized? What is, now that we have caught your cancer, how do we treat your cancer? And that team approach stays with you throughout your cancer treatment. And it's extraordinary. And there's a leader of a team, and there's everybody around the team, including mental and emotional components of cancer. And I want you to imagine for a world that we treated schizophrenia the same way. Just imagine it with me for a moment. Because I'm in the trenches. I am part of a team that treats schizophrenia, but I treat schizophrenia from a legal point of view because I'm the probate judge that comes in on commitment hearings. And 9 out of 10 commitments are because of schizophrenia. And imagine a world, and let's just make this world happen right now, in which we don't lump all mental illness together because they're not the same thing. Would you ever imagine lumping all physical illness together? It's medieval. Cancer is not the same as ALS, which is not the same as a broken toe or arthritis. Physical illness affects the body. Mental illness affects the mind. Bipolar disorder may occasionally have some symptoms that overlap occasionally with some symptoms of schizophrenia. They're not the same disease. Depression is not the same as schizophrenia. So let's stop talking about mental illness as if it's one category. It isn't. It isn't, and it shouldn't be thought of or discussed as so. Schizophrenia is its own thing, and it's a disease that typically begins manifesting symptoms in your early 20s, but not always. Sometimes it can manifest a little earlier. Sometimes it can manifest later, and it manifests with delusion and paranoia. So that you are boring holes into your walls because you believe people are spying and wires are coming into you and you can't stop the terrible obsessive thoughts that someone else is trying to intrude on your brain. And it manifests with delusions, very often with auditory hallucinations and sometimes olfactory, sensory hallucinations, smell hallucinations, hearing hallucinations, and visual hallucinations. And it manifests in a thought disorder in which someone is incoherent to another person. They may string words together, but they make no sense. And you know schizophrenia when you see it. A psychiatrist knows it within minutes. Within minutes, they can tell when somebody has an acute exacerbation of a schizophrenic episode or a schizophrenia stage. And I want us to imagine a world, just for a moment, just for a moment, where when somebody gets a diagnosis of schizophrenia, a young man or a young woman in their 20s, in their 30s, that the entire family is immediately called to a table. They're not pushed at arm's length, elbow length because of an artificial designation that the person is over 18 and doesn't need a support system any longer to intrude on their quote unquote civil rights. Are you kidding me? Schizophrenia is a disease that affects a person, a family, and society. And imagine a world in which we looked at it that way, in which we said, okay, here's a person with schizophrenia. We acknowledge that this is possible. They say it's as common as 2% of our entire gene pool has schizophrenia. I don't know if it's that high. Maybe it's 1%. Maybe it's 1 out of 100 people. It's still a lot. And let's imagine a world in which everybody met at a table. Psychiatrists and therapists and social workers and housing people. And we said, okay, what stage of schizophrenia are we in? Have we caught this early? Will medicine now intervene in a way that will give this person a relatively functional life as long as they stay on the medicine? And what are the strategies that we are going to use to help a person voluntarily stay on the medicine so they don't have to be compelled to stay on the medicine? Because the after effects, the consequences of not staying on the medicine are not merely the very tragic, troubling consequences to an individual, but they are consequences that affect Michelle Goh when she's standing on a subway platform. Let's just imagine that world for a nanosecond in which we came out of the 11th century and came into the 21st century. And said, we know what this mental illness is, and we know what it does to a community, and we are going to have housing alternatives for people with schizophrenia, and we are going to reteach and reeducate families and doctors and nurses and the public about schizophrenia. And maybe we would avoid the next Michelle Goh, who had to be shoved off of a train platform. Why? You think there aren't people in the community that didn't already know that this person shouldn't have been out on the streets? Come on, everybody in the system knows when people are let out into the streets that it's a terribly inadequate societal response here in Connecticut and elsewhere. Everybody knows it. Every nurse knows it. Every social worker knows it. Every psychiatrist knows it. We all know it. We all know it. I'm a judge and I know it. And our resources are too few and our options are too stingy. And look at the consequence today. And look at the consequence every day. And I want to say this. Schizophrenia is an altered state of mind. The person who has schizophrenia is not responsible in the same way that you and I think about criminal responsibility. A disease has taken over their mind. It is such a terrible and tragic disease, and I've seen it close up. And the vast majority of people with schizophrenia will not push anybody off of a train platform. They will never do that. Most likely, they will sit in their own room for hours and hours and days at a time if they're left untreated, staring at a wall, lost in their own thoughts. Tragic. And not grooming themselves and not bathing and sometimes not eating and completely shutting down. But this is a disease that we know, what this is, and we choose to ignore it. We choose to ignore it. Let's be honest about that. It's not about more police on subway platforms. That's a Band-Aid. You want to put more police to feel better? Go ahead, do it. Put the Band-Aid approach on. We already know who this gentleman was. He's already been cycled in and out of hospitals for 20 years. He should have been in a clean, supervised housing situation with people supervising him taking his medicines. And the day he doesn't take his medicine, he gets admitted into an institution where he's forced to take his medicine that much longer until his brain retrains itself. He comes back out and then he goes back into supervised housing. Supervised housing. Come on. I just want you to imagine for a moment that we looked at schizophrenia the way we looked at cancer. And we saw it for what it is with clear eyes. It's nobody's fault. Cancer's nobody's fault. People aren't blamed for getting cancer. It's nobody's fault. This is the human condition that we were born into. We have genes that unravel. We have environmental things that go wrong. We are not destined to be immortal. We are destined at one point or another to leave this planet and go on to wherever it is we go on or not, because the human body has an expiration date. And on the way to its expiration date, it gets sick. And schizophrenia is a condition of illness of the body that affects the mind. I'm Lisa Wexler, 203-333-9422, and my sincerest condolences to the families and friends of Michelle Goh for a completely unavoidable catastrophe. We'll be right back.
It's time for you to have a say. 203-333-9422. Now, back to the Lisa Wexler Show on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
203-333-9422 is our number. You can call me at 203-333-9422. And I want to continue a little bit in case you want to talk and share about your thoughts about talking about schizophrenia, imagining a world in which it's treated the way we treat cancer, thinking about mental illness not as a global, oh, all mental illness lumped in the same way, but the individual diseases that they are, and the completely avoidable tragedy of Michelle Goh being pushed off of a train platform by somebody who had cycled in and out of hospitals for over 20 years. One of the drill-down aspects of this, of course, is insurance, and that tends to be, unfortunately, the driving impetus for whether or not care is actually received. And how silly and dumb is that? Allowing our insurance companies to get away with not treating certain mental illnesses, schizophrenia, depression, bipolar, the way they would have to treat cancer. So just go back to the analogy. Imagine a world in which we treated schizophrenia the way we treated cancer. You know, one of the things we talk about a lot in my world of hearings is who has access. Who's supposed to know when someone is committed? Who's supposed to know when a hospital is asking for a conservator in order for the conservator to have the specific limited purpose of being able to give the authority to compel someone to be taking medicine even when they don't want to? So here's the scenario. Here's the scenario. Somebody is found dancing naked in January weather on top of a car in, you pick a town, Stratford, Trumbull, Bridgeport, Fairfield. And the police are called, and they rightly recognize this. We give them kudos immediately for recognizing this not as a criminal acting out or a trespass or a breaching of the peace. The police recognize this, and I give thanks to the police all the time, for recognizing this as an aspect of acute mental illness. So instead of taking the person to the jail, they bring him to the local ER at Bridgeport Hospital. And this person, Al Smith, is brought to the hospital where the psychiatrist on staff admits the person on what we call a physician's emergency certificate, a PEC. And the state of Connecticut allows somebody to be admitted against their will for up to 15 days. After that, they have to be let go, except that there's a one big unless. So Al Smith goes from Bridgeport Hospital to a localized mental health hospital like St. Vincent's, which happens to be located in Westport in my probate district. And Al is there for 15 days, and Al is still in the throes of an acute schizophrenic episode or acute schizophrenic aspect. And he is hearing voices. He is talking to those voices out loud, what they call responding to internal stimuli in the biz. And Al is persuaded and truly convinced with a very completely confirmed belief system that everybody else is wrong and sick and he's perfectly fine. And the fact that he decided to be naked and danced on the top of a Volkswagen was perfectly consistent with the voices that were telling him to do so. And when he gets to the hospital, he can't really string words together in a coherent way. He has stopped eating. He has a religious preoccupation. And he opens the Bible constantly and sometimes reads out loud to himself, in which he believes either he is the Messiah or the Messiah is directly talking to him. I have seen this happen many times. And if you're a psychiatric nurse or someone who's a psychiatrist or a psychologist or someone familiar with schizophrenia, you hear the familiarity with which I'm talking about in terms of a fact pattern. And Al Smith is at the hospital and he is 30 years old. And he has a life outside the hospital. But the hospital isn't allowed to call anybody. They're not allowed because of HIPAA, okay, because of this privacy construct that we have placed on top of a layering of everybody. Now, HIPAA was originally written and is still intended to protect privacy interests. And I agree with that. And I'm all about privacy. But how does a privacy interest attach to somebody in the throes of schizophrenia? Explain it to me, because I would like to know. How is there a legitimate privacy interest in somebody whose thoughts are so incapacitated, who was so unable to connect with reality, that left to his own devices, he will lose 40 or 50 pounds? He may become completely dehydrated and have to be transferred back to an ER for IV. He will not be able to function in this world in any meaningful way. And left to his own devices, will be released out into the January cold, where he could die of hypothermia the next time he decides to go naked on top of a car. Tell me how there is a legitimate privacy interest attached to that. You want to give me a privacy interest? I need to have a capacitated brain. A privacy interest attaches to a person who understands privacy. So we have a situation where you have an overlay. I'm just giving you one example of how fucked, okay, of how screwed up our system is when it comes to addressing schizophrenia. So we have a system in which somebody is in a hospital and their mother, their father, their children, their siblings, their best friend, their landlord, their social worker, their visiting nurse, their doctor. Many people in their world are not able to be communicated with to even know where Al Smith ended up that day. Do you know how often it is that parents and cared and loved ones are calling hospitals, freaking out because they don't know where their loved person is? They end up calling the police, reporting somebody is missing, and it can take days sometimes before they find out that that person is in fact admitted into a health hospital, admitted into an emergency hospital in a mental health ward. So, okay, so now I'm the judge and there's a hearing going on because I've told you that Al Smith is in the hospital for 15 days and he has no intention ever of voluntarily taking any medicines because he believes they're all poison and he believes that everybody is out to poison him. And there is no way that he will voluntarily take any medicine. No way, a shot or a pill. No way, no way, no how, no way. So a hospital says to itself, well, it's not in this person's medical interest to be discharged. He's not able to be discharged. He's not able to function safely in the community. If we discharge him, he'll just be back the next day. So we go to court and we ask for permission to commit this person. And that is an entirely statutorily framed procedure that is entirely designed to protect the civil rights of Al Smith. And I totally agree with all of it. No issues. You have to have two independent psychiatrists, one of whom must be a psychiatrist, unaffiliated with the hospital admitting. So there's no issue of money or anything like that, or having someone commit so that you have another patient. And they come into the hospital and they examine Al Smith and they give an opinion to the court whether they agree that he's dangerous to himself or others or gravely disabled, and that the hospital is the least restrictive place where he can be. And if they meet those criteria, they report to the court, they testify to the court, they get cross-examined by an attorney representing Al Smith, and we have a full trial. And I'm the judge presiding over the trial because I'm a probate judge, and that's what probate judges do in Connecticut. And I decide if by clear and convincing evidence, there's a determination that Al Smith is either dangerous to himself because he's likely to go and be back out on a car naked in January, or dangerous to others because he's running around with a knife. In this case, Al isn't, but sometimes they do. Or gravely disabled, which for sure Al is gravely disabled. Can't function. Unable to function. And then he gets committed. And the judge doesn't decide when he gets out. That's a medical decision. He leaves when the hospital thinks that he should. But who's at that table? Are all the parents at that table? Not necessarily. Are the friends at that table? Not necessarily. We have developed a system that does not address the specific needs and situations of people with schizophrenia. And we could easily make these changes if we wanted to. We could easily recognize that in some situations there should be an exception to HIPAA. It's not a, you know, a major leap of intellect here. And if an attorney for the person who's always appointed thinks that someone in the room, that the harm of that person listening outweighs the benefit, that's very easy. Then they don't get to be part of the hearing. But what if there is a benefit? What if we now can all understand how Al got to this situation? When just 6 months ago, Al was functioning very well, taking his medicines, getting dressed every day, showering and going on to do his life. How did he get from A to B? Nobody in the hospital knows. They never know. He just appears there like a ghost. I'm sick and tired of it. I'm sick and tired of it. We need a different approach. I'm Lisa Wexler. We'll be right back. 203-333-9422.